Okay, guys, it's summer fun drive time at the Scott Horton Show. Bills are piling up and equipment is wearing out. So here's the deal. Anyone who donates $50 or more gets a chance to win a week's vacation for two to Costa Rica. Drawing is July 15th. Winner, go whenever you want. See more details at scotthorton.org/raffle. Anyone who donates $100 or more gets entered into the raffle, plus a 1-ounce silver QR code commodity disc from commoditydiscs.com. And the first 25 people to donate $100 or more will also get a copy of Your Money or Your Life, Why We Must Abolish the Income Tax by Sheldon Richman, or the audiobook of Lou Rockwell's Fascism versus Capitalism, narrated by me, for free. Stop by scotthorton.org/donate or scotthorton.org/raffle for details. You can also sign up for monthly donations by way of PayPal, per interview at Patreon, support with Bitcoin, and shop through scotthorton.org/Amazon. And thanks. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Libertarian foreign policy, mostly. Our next guest is Kamal Alam. He is a Syria military analyst and fellow for Syrian affairs at the Institute for Statecraft. And Brad Hoff over at Levant Report pointed him out to me in this great article, a very interesting piece here. Pax Syriana, neither vanquished nor all conquering. And you write it here about how, despite all the predictions for now 4 years running, the Assad regime is in fact not on the verge of collapse. And you attempt to explain why that is. If it's okay, I guess I'll start with, is it because of Hezbollah and Russia and Iran helping? Or it's because of more internal factors and that's more of a side issue? Or how do you balance out the foreign intervention on Assad's behalf versus internal factors?
So you see, the conventional wisdom talks about foreign intervention helping the Assad government and the army surviving. But I believe that if it wasn't for the internal structure of the army and the state, there is no way the Syrian army or Assad would have survived for now more than 4 years. There's only so much external actors can do. Because if you actually look at the Russian and Iranian and Hezbollah support for Assad, it's not even half of what the Americans and the Gulf Arab states are throwing behind the opposition. So if we balance the two supporting cast members here, i.e. America, the European Union, and the Gulf Cooperation Council, their support to all the different rebel groups, half of them that are terrorists, far outweigh what the Russians, Iranians, and Hezbollah are doing to the Syrians. The bulk of the fighting is being done by the Syrian Arab army. Mm-hmm. And, you know, an army marches on its stomach, and there is no way in any military combat history that the army is able to fight in its own land for so long with foreign support. You need some local support, and people just seem to ignore the fact that Assad has support in his own country.
Mm. Well, now, so here's the thing about it, and I don't want anybody to get the idea that me or this show, that we're any friends of Assad here. I don't know exactly what you think about him personally here, but this isn't really about that. We're just talking about the news and the politics and the reality of the situation. And I don't think I've ever heard anyone argue that Assad is anything other than a fascist dictator. If anybody is saying, yeah, but, what they're saying is, yeah, but his opposition are a bunch of bin Ladenite head choppers. And so no wonder even large percentages of the Sunni population of the country actually support the Alawite dictatorship. Is that really right?
Yeah. That is right. Let me give you two big names who obviously you'd know who they are. Henry Kissinger and Zbigniew Brzezinski.
Sure.
These two, as you know, are the godfathers of U.S. foreign policy post-Cold War. And just in the last year, both Brzezinski and Kissinger are on record. You can find their testimony on C-SPAN congressional Senate hearings, saying, actually, we must acknowledge Assad has support. Now, what that means is, yes, he's a dictator because that's the norm in that region. You know, everyone's a dictator. But, you know, whether he's a dictator that's ever threatened Western security or regional security, that's another thing. And yes, he's a dictator. It's a one-party state. But how many people were actually against him in the initial uprisings? And how this turned into a brutal, brutal, barbaric civil war. So, yes, it's not about Assad the man himself, because it's not about one man. You know, there is no way one man can be in power for that long. It's the system, it's the state, and yes, you're right, a lot of the Sunnis support an Alawi leader. That's because he's married into one of the important Sunni families. His brother is married to a Sunni. It's not an Alawi government, it's just an Alawi president.
Okay, now, just for oversimplicity's sake, if it's all right with you, I'm just a white guy in Texas here. What the hell do I know about this stuff? But if we could go back to the Libya war, it seemed there things were much more clear-cut. Everybody was a Sunni, I believe, basically. It wasn't so much ethnic or sectarian, but it was more the bin Ladenites in the east versus the commies in the west. And America took the side of the bin Ladenites, and they had the air power and all of NATO behind them. And it was really just a matter of time, even though they didn't have too many fighters on the ground. It just took, you know, I guess enough 9 months or so of NATO planes and special forces on the ground to finally just get the job done. Gaddafi didn't have much of a state really in the first place, or much of an army. He just had, you know, his own personal Gestapo, I guess, but was afraid to create enough of an army that they could depose him, right? So that one was, it was so kind of clear cut. Just, it was just a march west, and it's just a matter of time. As horrible as it was, and even though it took a lot longer than they said it was going to take, it seemed pretty inevitable. Whereas at the same time, the Syrian war was breaking out, and I remember Pepe Escobar especially broke it down like this, where he said, you know, it's a super majority Sunni country, but a huge percentage of the Sunnis support the dictatorship, because the revolution there is made up almost entirely of you know, suicide bomber, head chopper crazies. And, you know, there's it. So it's not the kind of thing where, like, the Iraqi Civil War, where the lines were very clear cut and that kind of deal. And that it was basically just the poor and the working class Sunnis out from the countryside who were even susceptible to joining up this revolution. And that virtually every other ethnic and sectarian group in the country, including all of the merchant class Sunnis, I guess, is how he characterized them, that they were all the coalition for the current state, as fascist as it is. Is that accurate for 2011? And is that pretty much an accurate comparison to the Libya situation, do you think? And is that, does it hold true today, if it's right at all?
It's definitely accurate in 2011 and through most of the current conflict. And, you know, this is, again, just like Pepe Escobar, the Britain and Europe's, and I would say the world's top Syrian expert was a man called Patrick Seale, who passed away a couple of years ago. Patrick Seale, who's an award-winning, best-selling academic and author, said exactly the same thing Pepe Escobar says, that yes, it might be an authoritarian fascist state, but he has the support of the majority of the country, including the Sunni elites. Yes, it was not a perfect state. Things were happening behind closed doors. But at the same time, there were no major calls for regime change. There were calls for reform. So let's not forget that the initial protests were definitely genuine. People genuinely came out on the streets looking for reform. But it got hijacked very quickly by, as you say, head-chopping terrorists. Yeah. Going back to Libya.
Wait, hold it right there. I'm sorry to interrupt, but we got to take this break. But we'll pick it right up with the Libya metaphor and all that, or analogy, right on the other side of this break. It's Kamal Alam. You can find this article at opendemocracy.net. Pax Syriana. Back in just a minute. Hey, all, Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. If this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Roberts & Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Roberts & Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. All right, guys, welcome back to the show. Talking with Kamal Alam. He's got this article called Pax Syriana, Neither Vanquished Nor All-Conquering. Oh, that's for sure. He's at opendemocracy.net. That's where you can find this article. And he is a military analyst and fellow for Syrian affairs at the Institute for Statecraft, which I don't know anything about. But anyway, very interesting article here. And I'm sorry, because I ask big, long, involved questions, and then sometimes they don't even have a question at the end of them. But you were going to respond to my rambling about trying to compare my best understanding of the differences, really, between the more or less ease of the regime change in Libya in 2011 versus America and its allies' very stalled attempt to overthrow Assad in Syria ever since then.
The thing what happened in Libya was obviously there was heavy American firepower use, whilst in Syria, American firepower has not been used on assets that are being used by Assad yet. So there is a key difference there that obviously if American bombs start falling on Assad's military and air force, you know, then maybe the story could have been different. Whilst in Libya, actually American coordinates and ordnance were actually dropping on Gaddafi's forces. But obviously the other big difference is Gaddafi never had an army. You know, as you just mentioned, he had a few private militias, and Libya had never really fought any war in its 40, 50 year history that Gaddafi ruled Libya, while Syria actually was the main force that stabilized the Lebanese civil war. And at the same time, Syria had a proper army that took part in the first Gulf War coalition. It was a proper army trained by the Soviets, the Russians. So it knew what it was doing. So, and also, it's a very much more sophisticated civilized state. Whilst Libya is basically barren desert with all these tribes who hate each other. They might all be Sunnis, but they hate each other. And if you look what's happened in Libya now, is Libya is full of terrorists. There are at least 12 different designated terrorist groups ruling Libya. All kinds of, you saw what happened recently in France and Tunisia, and both those attackers were apparently trained in Libya. So we're actually seeing the, you know, the amazing success of the Libyan revolution, which has basically born nothing but terrorism.
Yeah, of course, it spread the war to Mali, I thought that this would have just been propaganda, but there's actually some pretty credible journalism about the jihadists in the Mali war hooking up with Boko Haram and help making them worse. They were already existed, but now they got RPGs and training and a little bit more indoctrination in the dogma of the Islamic State, which they declare their allegiance to. Another
Absolutely.
Consequence of the Libya yeah. war there, yeah.
I mean, I'll give you another example. Someone I've done some work for, General David Richards, who's the former British Chief of Defense Staff, the equivalent of the Chairman Joint Chiefs in America. He actually came on TV during the Libyan war saying, we are not actually trying to do regime change in Libya. He was rebuked within 2 hours by the British Prime Minister and the Defense Secretary, Liam Fox. And there was a big rift in the British Army against the civilian government in Britain, because basically the British Army said, we can't take Gaddafi out. If we take Gaddafi out, there'll be a whole shitstorm on Europe's doorstep. And that's exactly what happened. So even within the military, like I said, establishment of NATO, no one really wanted to go after Gaddafi. All they wanted to do was create a no-fly zone and protect Libyan civilians that were being killed by Gaddafi. And actually what happened later was a complete mess. And today, almost all the so-called experts who were wrong on Libya and Syria are basically the same kind of charlatans who are calling for military intervention in Syria when there is no credible opposition to replace Assad. You know, it's just a bunch of terrorists.
Right. And in fact, you know what? I probably overdo this, but let me play this clip for you real quick. It's a couple of clips of Hillary Clinton when she was still the Secretary of State in 2012. And she's on CBS News. It's the very end of February 2012. And she's being asked, why aren't we doing more to help the rebels against Assad? Because, of course, that's been the narrative all along here, is that the rebels are the good guys and Assad, of course, the evil dictator. And so here's, you know, she's in a position of, she was really the hawk on this, but here she's explaining Obama's position, basically defending from that accusation. And she says,
we know Al-Qaeda, Zawahiri, is supporting the opposition in Syria. Are we supporting Al-Qaeda in Syria? Hamas is now supporting the opposition. Are we supporting Hamas in Syria? So I think, Wyatt, you know, despite the great pleas that we hear from those people who are being ruthlessly assaulted by Assad, if you're a military planner or if you're a Secretary of State and you're trying to figure out, do you have the elements of an opposition that is actually viable, we don't see that.
And that was at the beginning of 2012. Right when Jabhat al-Nusra was really becoming a thing, way back then, though, 3.5 years ago. And yet, that's really the policy that she continued to advocate for, backing, de facto at least, backing al-Qaeda in Syria. More and more we hear calls, even in foreign affairs, On the front page of Foreign Affairs, they're not even afraid to say it's time to work with Al-Qaeda to bring them in from the cold, the guys that did the 9/11 attacks and 10 attacks before that, and make friends with them because, hey, they're fighting Assad. What do you make of that? In fact, let me ask you this, because everybody knows that America's allies, Saudi, Qatar, Turkey, and now even Israel have been, maybe all along Israel, have been on the side of the bin Ladenites there. But I wonder whether you think that there's some kind of real level of frustration by the Americans that, geez, all our allies are doing this, or is this really all just plausible deniability for what's a clear American NATO policy to outsource to our Middle Eastern friends the care and feeding of the suicide bombers of Syria, as the Israelis put it in the New York Times unashamedly? If their goal isn't regime change now, it's let's keep the war going as long as we can and bleed everybody to death, they said. Do you think there's much of a contradiction? Because some say, geez, we just can't control the Saudis. But I'm thinking, really? Because I thought that was kind of the deal, is that we can.
He says it's quite common knowledge that Saudis obviously use checkbooks and money diplomacy. They don't have much intellectual capacity to do good in the world. So they replace that with the oil money that they have. And, you know, this is a repeat of Afghanistan in the 1980s where, you know, where the war in Afghanistan was portrayed as a brutal Russian invasion of Afghanistan, but actually it completely forgot that a lot of Afghans actually supported communism and there was a massive indigenous communist movement in Afghanistan. And even so, very similarly here, what you have is the Saudis and the Gulf allies are basically repeating what they did in Afghanistan 30 years ago. And Turkey is doing the same thing Pakistan did. So just like Pakistan was the kind of frontline person that ran the American war with Saudi money in the 80s, now it's the Turks running that war. And it's going to hit Turkey as well. That's where Erdogan's lost his election, because all the major opposition parties of Turkey have come out and said, we don't support Turkish policy in Syria. Much more so, MHP and CHP, the two opposition parties, have actually gone and met Assad in Damascus, which goes to show you what the Turkish opposition think of the whole war. And that's where Erdogan's lost the war, lost the election. But yes, in some aspects, you're right. The Americans have basically outsourced some parts of the war to the Gulf allies.
But, you know, I mean, they portray the situation as though, well, the Americans, they're willing to train and arm the moderates, just a few of them, the CIA some here and the military some there. And boy, yeah, it's a little bit frustrating. As I said, they're now kind of spinning the alliance with Al-Qaeda a little bit more, rehabilitating them. But the narrative at least has been, as Joe Biden put it in his famous comments at Harvard, that, geez, our allies have just gone and done something crazy here. And I wonder if you think that that's just cynical cover, or if the Americans really have been trying to get them to stop backing these guys, since it's become clear that, you know, the Americans, the State Department, Hillary put al-Nusra on the terrorist list as soon as they called themselves al-Nusra. So, but anyway, I don't mean to be too conspiratorial about it, but then again, it's kind of hard to ignore that, you know, they still to this day are backing some rebels, and it seems like all the money and weapons end up in the hands of the guys who are really not afraid to die, which would be al-Nusra and ISIS.
I think there's a confusion of policy as well. So from my own work with the military, and what I've noticed, the confusion in all NATO countries, not just America, is that this initial idea to support democracy and human rights. So that's how it all started. And there are a lot of lobbyists in London and Washington that are paid by the Saudis and the Qataris and also the UAE, who basically, these are Libyan exiles, these are Syrian exiles, who claim to be democratic and claim to be moderate. These are the people who kept telling the Americans, don't worry, we look after everything, you know, but actually it took America maybe a couple of years to realize that these exiles are all frauds. So what you have is a dual track policy of still trying to find and equip a moderate rebel force. But even last month, General Mike Nagata, head of the US Special Forces, who's in charge of all this, said, we don't even have 200 guys who are actually being vetted properly. And it's going to, and I think Martin Dempsey said yesterday, it's going to take a long time to vet. Well, I don't know how long you need when the war has gone on for 4 years, 300,000 dead. You know, there is just, the vetting process is flawed. The exiles in Washington and London are all Islamic radicals with without beards. They're all clean shaven and pretend to be moderates, and they charm State Department officials, and they cry about human rights abuses and genocides and all that. And yes, of course, human rights abuses are taking place, but the way these guys portray themselves is as if they are the good guys, and they start making comparisons to World War II and concentration camps and etc. Well, it's actually, there's nothing even close to compare this war to what happened in World War II.
All right, now, forgive me for keeping you over just a little bit here, but can I ask you whether you think anybody in London or D.C. is finally coming around to the idea that maybe they could negotiate an end to this thing instead of just bleeding everybody to death forever the way they're doing? And if so, is there anybody to negotiate with? As Obama himself said, hey, the idea there are a bunch of, and that Hillary Clinton clip, we don't see that. The moderates to, the moderate leaders to negotiate with, Obama said the same thing. It's, you know, a fantasy that you'd have had a bunch of moderate leaders, doctors and lawyers and pharmacists. I don't know where they got that line from. That's what they say on Fox News too. Well, it was all a bunch of moderate doctors and pharmacists who were the moderates leading the rebellion until Obama didn't do enough to help them and the terrible jihadis came, et cetera. But So is there anybody to negotiate? If anybody, like, say they wanted to bring in, I don't know, some third party from some country nobody ever heard of to host the negotiation from a disinterested view, is there even a settlement available here at this point?
We see so far both the Geneva meetings failed, as you know, and the last meeting that Moscow held between the rebels and Assad. It's looking extremely difficult in terms of finding a new country to host it. It has to be a country with clout, and that's either Russia, America itself, or Switzerland being the kind of classic neutral country. But actually, the end to this war is not that difficult. People keep saying, oh, this is a terribly complicated conflict. No, it's not, because at the end of the day, if you know what the problem is, it's easy to, everyone in America knows Turkey's letting terrorists across the border. Everyone knows the money is coming from the Gulf countries. And if the United States and its allies want to put an end to the bloodshed, the first thing they need to do is stop their allies letting in the terrorists. And at the same time, then put pressure on Iran and say, listen, we've stopped our shit. If you don't stop backing the guys from your end, we're going to come after you. So for me, you know, it's the simplest way of putting it, that the diagnosis is there, you know, the prognosis is wrong. All the money being wasted on the rebel groups, it's not going to lead anything. The terrorists are taking more and more territory every day. Everyone, you know, even the so-called moderate rebels executed, you know, about 2 or 3 dozen people 2 days ago. So it just doesn't make sense.
Yeah, the FSA has been head chopping and suicide bombing all along too. As bad as the.
But and also an answer to one of your, also in answer to one of your questions, there are people in America and Britain who, like I said, believe that it is time to stop the craziness. And as I said, Henry Kissinger and Brzezinski might be in their late 80s and early 90s, but these guys, you know, are still the people who everyone looks up to. They've openly called for that we need to go talk to Assad. Two former heads of the British Army, Richard Dannett and David Richards, have said, well, we must talk to Syria and Assad themselves to bring an end to this conflict. Otherwise, nothing is happening.
All right, y'all, that's Kamal Alam. He's at Open Democracy. .net. This article is called Pax Syriana, Neither Vanquished Nor All-Conquering. And you can find him also at Levant Report. And he is a military analyst and fellow for Syrian Affairs at the Institute for Statecraft. Appreciate your time on the show today.
All right. So thanks. Thank you. Thanks.
You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers? Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck.
Don't you get sick of the Israel lobby trying to get us into more wars in the Middle East? Or always abusing Palestinians with your tax dollars? It once seemed like the lobby would always have full-spectrum dominance on the foreign policy discussion in D.C. But those days are over. The Council for the National Interest is the America lobby, standing up and pushing back against the Israel lobby's undue influence on Capitol Hill. Go show some support at councilforthenationalinterest.org. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.
Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. darrenscoffee.com.